All right, everybody, a quick promotion here. The Independent Labor Club of New York City is having its big opening gala, our coming out party, if you will. And that, of course, has to be on May 1st, May Day. We are going to have a barbecue and we are going to have a film screening. If you're interested in the barbecue, it's going to be in the grilling section of McCarran Park in Brooklyn at 3 p.m. You'll find us. We'll have big ILC banners and everything like that. If you can't make that because you're working, that's okay. We will be at Woodbine Space. We'll make sure the address is in the show notes for this. But Woodbine Space in Ridgewood, Queens at 7 p.m., where we're going to be showing awesome films. We'll do a film screening, and we'll have rousing socialist speeches there. So do come out for May Day if you've been interested in the project but unable to make meetings or anything, or if you just want to come hang out and do something on May Day besides, you know, march up and down, not that there's anything wrong with that, come hang out with us. So hope to see a bunch of you there. Thanks so much.
Yeah, so we're recording this on Sunday, April 14th. I'm not sure when it'll be released, maybe in a couple weeks, and hopefully we won't be in World War III by then. Or
oh my God, watching
touch
like
and go at the moment.
It was like that scene in Austin Powers. I don't know if you guys remember that movie where they're in the steamroller and that guy's like, no, but they're like going closer and closer to him at like 2 miles per hour. That was the experience of watching on social media last night. Like the drones take 8 hours to go from Israel and then the ballistic missiles start. And it was
that was the craziest part because like you're seeing it in real time. And I think most of us didn't have a concept of how long it actually takes like a bunch of drones to fly from Iran to Israel. And it's like, oh, it makes sense. It's, you know, a few hours, but then you're just like constantly updating. Be like,
yeah, I think to be serious for a second, we'll know by the time this episode comes out, whether, the United States can hold its rabid genocidal attack dog Israel back, because it's clear that both Iran and the United States want to, you know, put a line under this thing and say that's enough. You know, let's consider this done. But the chance that Netanyahu, that genocidal maniac, will not respond in kind, I think, is pretty low. Mm. So watch this space. Stay tuned for World War III.
Yay.
All right. So we're talking with Ray and Boris from the Empire Never Ended podcast and Anti-Politica Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hey. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
I love having other podcasters on because I don't even listen to that many podcasts myself, so I had the pleasure of listening to yours, and it turns out it's really fucking good and really listenable, so thanks so much for that.
Yeah, it's very funny, and I'm learning so much from it.
Totally.
Like your series about American Legion, you know, there's an American Legion hall like two blocks from me and I walk past it every day. And I had no idea it was a fascist headquarters.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, they're so ubiquitous in the U.S. that like I never even thought to look into it. It's never something that crossed my mind until we started reading some stuff and it kept coming up. And I was like, holy shit, it's a fucking proto-fascist militia made up of like industrialist families and like... Like what?
Like Andy, I was drawn immediately to that one, like of your archives. I went and listened to that one directly because it kind of overlaps with some of the interests that Andy and I and others in our group have in like civil social organizations and like, you know, organizing outside the state and like the public sphere or whatever. But like the overlap of early 20th century progressivism and this proto-fascism, as you say, gives real pause to like what this looks like in the United States, at least in the 20th century.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Who would have thought a group called the American Legion would be questionable politically? And then bad as they were, you go into the Black Legion, which was like the Waffen SS of the American Legion or the Gestapo or is That was totally insane. I had no idea how large that group was and how militant they were, how powerful they were.
Yeah, and weren't there other Balkan groups that were also called Legion, like during the 30s and 40s?
There was a Black Legion in Croatia. So like the main like collaborationist Ustasha militia, the ones that were like, kind of their Einsatzgruppen were called the Black Legion.
Yeah, they were the ones who were sent. Were they sent to the Eastern Front?
Some of them were, but they were also the ones that did a lot of like the massacres in 41, like the early years.
They got what they deserved on the Eastern Front. I think that one of the lessons we have from this early on in the episode is if you see an organization out there, it's got Legion in the name.
Yeah, it's not good.
You're going to want to avoid them or send them to the Eastern Front if it's a possibility.
Yeah.
Even if it's a comedy podcast network.
It's suspect.
Indeed.
So, yeah, tell us a little bit about Empire Never Ended, how you got started, and what you focus on.
Well, so we call it a Balkan Amerikanski podcast. So it's three of us, actually. There is a third person, Fritz, who's not here today. So it's a podcast that focuses on, discussing fascists, but we sort of have two areas of focus. And we approach these topics in thematic arcs that are getting longer and longer and longer. And we usually try to kind of combine to one arc that's focused on Western fascists, mostly from the US, although we talked a little bit about British fascists as well. And then we do an arc that's focused on Balkan nationalist history. And currently we are in what arc? I don't even know.
Four, something like that.
Yeah, and we are discussing American fascists again. This is our second arc about American fascism. Previously, we did a long arc about... we wanted to do an arc about Serbian and Croatian anti-communist terrorists from the Cold War era. But then, as we usually do, we started from the 19th century, and it was a very long arc, yeah.
And so that became its own arc, and then we got around to all the like 60s and 70s emigre groups in the West, but like a year later.
Yeah. And so the three of us are like, we're anarchists and we are friends for a very long time. And we come from the anarchist and the punk and the anti-fascist scenes. And we had this bizarre interest into these freaks for a long time. And so it's a Balkan Amerikanski podcast because all of us have some connection with the Balkans. Some of us were born there, some have family from there, some lived there for a long time.
So why did you decide to make a podcast focusing on the right? I guess like a broader question is like, why are we as leftists just so fascinated with the minutiae of the right?
I think like for me, I don't know, like it, I remember being in kind of more kind of street level anti-fascist stuff back in like the early mid 2000s, and you'd always end up kind of looking up some of these people that, you know, you're beefing with, and then just finding out like, oh, okay, Rahoa and like World Church of the Creator, these guys like worship the white man and think that like white people built the Great Wall of China or something. Hey, that's fucking crazy. And then you always end up kind of going into these conversations about how bizarre some of their philosophies are. And then, you know, with me and Fritz and Ray, we kind of were always talking about that kind of shit on our own. Like, hey, you know about these like Nazi Satanists in the UK and this, that, and the other thing. And as other like aging radicals do, we made a podcast out of it, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I also was involved in like this kind of antifa stuff since 16 years ago. And got involved with it because it seemed very kind of urgent locally where I was based back then to deal with it as a kind of a practical issue. And then you know, when you start doing something like that where the anti-fascist movement is not very strong, you have this feeling like in the first years, oh for sure I'm going to get stabbed at some point by some Nazis. So that's kind of something that you start paying more attention to fascists because of that. But also I think there's just, you know, I think everyone is not just, you know, the communists and anarchists who are kind of have this bizarre kind of dark interest into this topic. I mean, it is a very kind of bizarre and interesting topic in itself. And, you know, the Second World War was pretty important, and they were kind of the bad guys of that and never went away. And as, you know, communists and anarchists, we have this, usually this analysis that they serve a certain function for the ruling class. So we have this, I think, consciousness that it is quite possible for them to come back in a big way if it is, you know, needed. So it's quite a scary prospect. And also, a lot of them are really, really, like, very strange people or freaks sometimes. And so, yeah.
That's one of the cool things about getting into that history is that the left, we on the broader left, are filled with all sorts of interesting and weird cranks. And like, but we recognize their crankery, like we can recognize some rational kernel in there. But then there's the right, and their crankery, I feel like, and I'm thinking anywhere from somebody from like Dugin all the way down to those satanic you know, pagan Nazis in Great Britain in the 21st century. There's like something very titillating about the way that the right cranks out. That I myself am a crank collector, so I could appreciate it.
I mean, if you want to feel good about leftist drama, read Nazi drama. You know, they like kill each other and take it up a level.
More pertinent and maybe like a tougher question, right, is that given the history of the Balkans over the last 30 years, and I'm thinking about, of course, Serbian nationalism, Milosevic, the various ethnic cleansings and partial genocides that happened in the 1990s, and the kind of after effects of that, how do you see like fascism as or like extreme nationalism, we could say? Do you make a distinction between those things? And how does that relate to your analysis?
I mean, sometimes it's very hard to make this distinction, and it's a kind of more an academic question, and maybe it's more connected with what kind of a historical moment it is, whether we'll call something a nationalism or fascism. I think it's these are closely related phenomenon, and I think that's how we look at them. So we are a very anti-nationalist podcast, and that's shaped by the experience of the anarchist and anti-war movement that comes out of the experience of the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s, because that kind of movement, which is not a big movement, never was, but it was born out of the anti-war efforts of, in particular, anarchists from Croatia and Serbia who weren't connected during the war. But then later on, there was also a connection with the anti-militarist anarchists of Greece was established. So, who also have this kind of anti-nationalist focus, in addition to being anti-fascist.
So was NATO anti-fascist when they bombed in the 1990s?
No, they're anti-communists.
No. Short answer, no.
Okay.
And not anti-communist either, for the Parenti fans out there, I guess.
Well, we're going to move on to Balkan stuff in a second. One thing that I learned listening to Empire Never Ended was, like I mentioned, the Black Legion, and they had this plan for a fascist coup in the United States, and they had like a code word they were going to put in the newspapers announcing that it was time for the coup. And it was kind of a horrifying thing to listen to, because given the strength of the organization, their political connections, their connections in the police with the KKK and everything, it seemed plausible that they could pull it off. And it made me think that, I don't know, there's kind of like a silver lining to listening to it, that they didn't pull it off.
Yeah.
And obviously those same kind of groups exist today. There's the Republicans are inching closer and closer to explicitly white nationalist circles like the America First Network. And it makes me wonder if there's just something about the United States that's helped it resist the impetus to have a fascist coup. And I wonder if that's those antibodies are still in our bloodstream somehow, where it just obviously the upcoming Trump administration, there were some plans like this, like Plan 2024 or whatever. I don't know. I don't think it's the deep state exactly, but just something about the American civil society is just seems resistant to the concept of dictatorship and fascism.
Yeah, I mean, and then this comes down to, again, how you want to define fascism. Some people do it in that like very kind of traditional you know, okay, there's Italian fascism and then there's National Socialism and, right. you know, you can't call something that's not modeled after Italian fascism, fascism. But I mean, pretty much every American fascist group at some point or another had a plan or a fantasy for some sort of coup takeover scenario. Black Legion is scary because obviously they did have a ton of support in like, you know, government institutions. They'd even infiltrated the unions and the like, particularly since they were based in, you know, like industrial centers in the Midwest, like Detroit.
Henry Ford seemed to be a big supporter. Mm.
Exactly. But I think kind of the point, I mean, there was also like the business plot and all this other kind of attempted or so-called attempted fascist coups. I think what's kind of grim and scary about it is that they didn't really need to do that. And that's kind of when we come back to something like the American Legion, where you clearly see that like at after, you know, the American experience of the early 20th century and, you know, the labor movement and all kinds of radical groups that were active at the time, certain elements of the American ruling class kind of, made a conscious choice to align with kind of proto-fascist principles, right? So like coming out of World War, or right before World War One, you get the American Legion, which is comprised of, you know, if you, when we went through the list of founding members, it's like, you know, guys in the Stuyvesant family, Roosevelt's, all like wealthy industrialist families, political families, who essentially decided that, you know, they needed to create an alternative to, you know, the parallel society that existed in the US through like, you know, labor halls and ethnic halls and all this kind of stuff. And the way to do that was to, you know, get America into World War One and start a veterans organization before you had veterans of that war, right? So you know, they start as like a militia, then they turn into like the American Expeditionary Forces once America does come into the war, and then afterwards they have a tremendous amount of success starting these kind of Americanist lodges. And I think it's kind of speaks to how the American ruling class that, you know, was very anti-communist looked favorably at fascism in Europe always. And you get this, you know, it wasn't, that's not a secret at all. Like, you know, major media moguls in the US were saying that fascism was doing interesting and kind of good things in Europe. But that model, for example, of dictatorship, that's good for Italians, you know, because they're hot-blooded and whatever. Like America has like a different tradition. We don't need that here, but we do need to take like examples from them and just, you know, tweak a couple things here or there, you know, regulate immigration, you know, the Red Scare, the first Red Scare, deport, you know, radicals from the country and make people into proper Americans. And so that's kind of the, I don't know, long-winded conspiratorial I think answer that I can give.
Maybe there's like a conspiratorial aspect in that what you're arguing is that the ruling class like implemented a plan or elements of it, let's say, in order to kind of set up a more militaristic and militia designed backbone to like American reaction. But at the same time, like if we're looking at things in a broader, like global perspective, and you nod to this in your American Legion episode, it's actually Theodore Roosevelt and like this progressivism. And then later on, of course, his cousin FDR taking up the corporatism of Wilsonian progressivism as well, that does for America in a certain sense what fascism does economically and corporatistically in Nazi Germany. But America, of course, having a completely different political and social system and a different conception of liberty, is able to have a, you could call it like a decentralized / centralized fascism, because if you're looking at like mob rule and like militias and violence against workers and against minorities or whatever, that can all happen in a very dispersed way in local communities where these like very strong city, state and regional barons and politicians can come together in order to like smash up any resistance to American capitalism. Whereas at the very top, because of a federated system, you could have a more loosey-goosey, kind of more imperial presidency, but you don't have to have the federal government sending jackboots into every home, because that's something that can be done on the local level.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
I think I have like a bit less optimistic view why a fascist coup didn't happen in the U.S. than what Andy suggested. I mentioned earlier that I think that, you know, fascism has a certain function in capitalist society, historically speaking. And so I think the ruling class opts for such an extreme measure as a fascist coup if the circumstances require that. And I think the U.S., you know, has a pretty stable political system. I mean, it's less and less stable, I think, but it's still pretty stable and was historically quite stable. I think that the interests of ruling class were usually not very, they were never really endangered by, you know, a rising socialist movement to the degree that happened in Europe.
Absolutely.
So for that reason, I think the ruling class didn't need such an extreme option. Unfortunately, the anarchists and the communists were not so strong in the US and are not currently. So I think if we saw the rise of those kinds of movement, there would be a greater chance of something like a fascist coup happening. Of course, the ruling class and their institutions are not always, you know, they're not super rational actors. They might decide to do something that's not. Smart, like to do a coup even there's no reason to do it. Like the CIA is not a very rational organization. I mean, they were doing coups abroad when people were coming into power who were not very radical. But so I was wondering, you know, when the Sanders movement was on the rise, would a faction of the ruling class see that as a possible like reason to do something like that? Although, like, from my view, that would be totally insane to do. I think that movement would like help integrate more people who are now kind of alienated from American capitalism into it and closely more identify with it. And I think such a like presidency, I think, would probably help stabilize the political system in the US more. But because they are pretty historically, you know, crazy, it's possible that they would do something as irrational as that.
The biggest pushback to Sanders in 2020 was Michael Bloomberg. And as Stalin asked of the Vatican, how many divisions does Michael Bloomberg have?
I guess, how big is the NYPD now?
Pretty big, 60,000 or something. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the reaction was the Democratic Party superdelegates, basically. Like, there's these antibodies to fascism in the U.S. body politic. There's also antibodies to any sort of socialist restructuring. You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt before. Roosevelt gets his start as a politician in reaction to the campaigns of Henry George in New York, running for mayor. He was a quasi-socialist, populist, a cooperationist, trying to restructure the economy on like a popular cooperative model. And Roosevelt's first foray into politics is an explicit attempt to stop his campaign, which he does. So, yeah, I mean, the United States has always been white supremacist, always had this fascistic element to it, but it's always been in this balance against labor, against...
Yeah. And of course, let's not forget to mention that America's exterminationist tradition goes back to the very beginning.
Right.
But by the time German and Italian fascists are arriving, that process is concluded. It's concluded by the 1890s, the expansionist, eliminationist agenda of Manifest Destiny. And so we're talking about something that's proto because it literally happens before and in some small way an inspiration to the fascist modernization campaign, but also, like, of course, the Lebensraum Nazi program, which, again, the United States had settled earlier. You know, one of the advantages, of course, too, that the United States has in the 1920s and 1930s, and if you listen to the rhetoric among the various factions of the ruling class at that time, is that there was a sense among them that America was going to replace Britain almost quote unquote naturally as the global hegemon anyways. So there wasn't a need to do to violently impose that inside when all they had to do, of course, was to defeat the Nazis and bankrupt Britain in the process.
And then, of course, they have their hand in things like Gladio later on as well.
Sure. So, yeah.
To maintain that control in Europe.
Absolutely.
All right. So, yeah, let's move on to Europe and up for this America bullshit.
Yeah. Fuck America.
Yeah. Okay. So you two also work on a really impressive journal called Antipolitica, which is an explicitly
with a K.
with a K. That's how you know it's not American.
Right.
So why did you start an anti-nationalist journal?
Yeah, so I'm one of the editors of Antipolitica. It's a Balkan anarchist journal that's edited by individuals and groups who come from the Balkans. Not all of them live there currently or have some Balkan connection. Like, we're not really, you know, the whole a category of the Balkans is not very well defined, which is also why we like using it. We, you know, basically, if you are our friend, you can be a part of the Balkan network that that works on Antipolitica, and like, we allow even Germans to write for our journal.
Germans. Controversially.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is a line from a Yugoslav partisan movie is, a German is human too. So we believe in that.
And you're anti-Deutsch too, obviously, so that's good.
Yeah.
Anti-Habsburgism was the original anti-Deutsch.
Yeah, yeah.
Anti-Ost-Deutsch or whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's only three issues of Antipolitica. It's published very rarely, but the issues are getting bigger and bigger. Now, the second and third issue have around 200 pages. There's a lot of text there. We decided to do it in two languages initially, in Serbo-Croatian, or however you want to call that language, and also in English, so that other comrades from other parts of the Balkans can read it as well. And then, starting from issue two, comrades in Greece also decided to make a Greek language edition as well. So, I mean, the idea was to try to kind of affirm more analysis, specifically from an anarchist, anti-nationalist, and like also anti-state communist position. And to try to help differentiate a little bit this from just kind of standard general leftist politics, because radical thinking and writing in most of the Balkans is not where it develops. You wanted to help that. Of course, an exception is Greece, where mm-hmm. there are many, many groups who have very specific analysis. So the movement is very differentiated there. But another reason why we wanted to start this journal was also to help to make friends from Greece translate their texts from Greek to English, because they write a lot, but only in Greek and rarely translate their texts, so that people from in the rest of the Balkans can also read it and translate it into their languages, because the movement in Greece is very interesting and very developed, but for a long time it didn't have a close connection to the rest of the Balkans. It was more closely connected to Western Europe than to the Balkans, although right. Greece is in the Balkans. But it changed, I think, in the last, I don't know, 15 years, these networks cooperation between anarchists developed.
So Antipolitica is like Brotherhood and Unity 2, Return of the Unity.
Yeah.
Or Return of the Fraternity and Sorority.
I think yeah, Ray would prefer to take it back to the early communists, right? The Balkan Federation, right?
Yeah, fair enough.
You always like bringing that up.
Yeah, the 19th century version of that, yeah.
Yeah.
If we want to, I think this project you have is very, very interesting, where you kind of have like a larger sort of analysis and ongoing commentary about like fascism of like the 20th century and up until today. But then in your journal, you really focus on, you know, the post-Yugoslav era and that area. I think having those two different frames and like levels of abstraction is really, really interesting. And how do you see these two projects? Like, I keep getting to this question of like, what does post-Yugoslavian nationalism and like classical fascism have in common? And how do you guys understand the interplay between those things and the potential for Serbian or Croat or, I don't know, Montenegrin nationalism to turn into something that, that rhymes with the 1930s or 40s?
I mean, if you have, well, okay. I mean, I think what was very important for us was now in issue three of Antipolitica is all about nationalism. And there, the longest text in that issue is about the nationalist policies of the Communist Party of Yugoslavia. And we wanted specifically to write that because a lot of leftists who come from the Yugoslav area, and people in general, but leftists included, have this idea that somehow suddenly in the 90s nationalism appeared in Yugoslavia, and before there wasn't any. I mean, that from a perspective of how many people saw their daily life is kind of true. Most people were not obsessed with these issues, but also it's completely not true in some more significant way. And that's that in our view, the whole Yugoslav political system was deeply nationalist the whole time. But it was, you know, the state was organized as a federation of nation states. And right, new nation states or in the forms of republics were introduced where before there were no nation states. And you had ruling so-called communist parties in each of the republic who were nationally defined. You know, they created ruling classes in each of the republics which were national and bureaucratic, and they were called, you know, in the 68 movement in Yugoslavia, they refer to them as the Red Bourgeoisie. And these are the people who would later opt for more kind of chauvinistic nationalist politics and policies in the 90s, in the war, when, you know, historical conditions changed. And then nationalism, we saw nationalism in its more brutal chauvinistic form and in a war that in the 90s we can see a kind of that war, we can I think see it is a primitive accumulation phase when the, you know, the new the some remnants of the Red Bourgeoisie transitioned into a classical kind of bourgeoisie, using the war as a way to, you know, extract capital, and did it in a way that was really kind of coordinated from different supposedly opposing sides. Like some newer journalistic research shows, although there were like signs of that always, you know, how the Croatian and the Serbian regime worked closely and were in business the whole time, were even, you know, selling ammo and weapons to each other during the war and were making money together and were like owning like same banks, for example, and like Serbian nationalist leader was keeping banks in Croatian, keeping money in Croatian banks during the war and so on. So there was a close connection, and I mean, we can see it even later on. And okay, now this is something that we talked about in the podcast. But you know, there were close connections between war criminals from Croatia and from Serbia, and like who then became leaders of organized crime, which is very, very closely connected. Like it's basically the same organization in Croatia and Serbia. All of these people are supposedly very nationalist and supposed to hate each other.
So like the sort of imposed unity of the Yugoslav state, starting with Tito, obviously, and then moving past him, is replaced by a sort of unity of these different ruling classes through primitive accumulation, capital accumulation, warlordism, organized crime. It was seen as an opportunity to kind of to keep the red bourgeoisie power base, but make it make it kept black, I guess, kept capitalist.
Although I think this idea of imposed unity is also, I think, a little bit problematic. I think this is people often have this idea. You know, Tito was the guy who had the skill to keep them together, all of these people who hated each other and so on. And we are also very much against this idea of ancient hatred being the reason for nationalism in the Balkans and so on. I think that, you know, the example I gave that people think that nationalism appeared in the 19s is also to a degree true for, like, ordinary people. They actually didn't hate each other and didn't think in those terms. But the structures, the political structures, they were much stronger than they were there. Maybe they were not paying attention to them, but they were there. And this is why I think the system was nationalist, because of how it was politically organized, not because people were chauvinistically inclined all the time or something, or just waiting an opportunity to kill each other. So I think that what the Communist Party did with their policies was almost kind of the opposite of what you said. It was like a kind of a forced and imposed disunity according to national lines. Like, for example, Boris in one of our episodes talked about how in the U.S., maybe you can say this if you want.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're doing some research into the immigrant communities in the U.S. in the 19th and early 20th century of Yugoslavs, South Slavs in the U.S. and Canada, who were by and large very leftist. You know, there's some statistic that in the 30s, like, you know, like a quarter of the U.S. Communist Party was South Slavic or origin or something like that. But what's interesting about it is when they first came to the U.S., they kind of organically came together based on common language, and they would open these, you know, halls that were kind of South Slavic labor halls and all this kind of other stuff. And then only in the 30s, when the Communist Party of Yugoslavia adopts... Well, actually, well, before that, they adopt it. But in the U.S., they really start to enforce the nationalities policies. They have to start separating all of these, you know, labor groups that existed in the U.S., and which was a very unpopular move among these people, to the point that they had to send, Stalin had to send a Comintern agent of Yugoslav origin to the U.S. to kind of sort things out and make sure that, like, you know, the Yugoslav hall is now a Serbian hall, a Croatian hall, and whatever. And that's very much like a forgotten history.
Marxist-Leninist nationalities policy strikes again, huh?
Jeez. Yes. Yeah. And that's kind of an example of what they did then when they took power, too, right? Because then they had this firm idea of nationalities... Nations get their own state, and nations are anybody who has no other homeland but the Yugoslav area, and then nationalities who may have other states in the region, so like Albania, Hungary, or whatever, they become nationalities and don't have a right to their own state, although they can get like autonomous rights and whatever. And so the system was conceptualized as a federation of very well-defined nation states.
Chalk one up for the United States in like the early 20th century as this moment, this place where internationalization can happen among the working class, as like the differences, the particular linguistic differences and whatever, dissolve themselves and actually have to be reimposed by actually existing socialism from abroad. That's a fascinating historical nugget, right?
And they were very much against it. And like when this guy, the Comintern agent, I mean, we have a couple episodes about it, but like he goes to the Spanish Civil War to lead some of the American divisions. And while he's gone, again, they start fucking dissolving the separate national groups and kind of reconvening, because there's no point in having two separate newspapers that used to be one. They're written in the same language. And so when he came back again after the Spanish Civil War, he had to sort things out again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's this Yugo-nostalgic idea, I assume in Yugoslavia too, but definitely among U.S. leftists, that like during World War II, all the Balkan people were trying to kill each other. Tito comes along, brings them all together, and then when he dies, it all falls apart at behest of expatriates trying to dominate new national markets that are emerging. But in the history of Yugoslavia, it's a history of nationalist riots. I think in Macedonia and Montenegro, there was like this perceived class order of nations with the Serbians on top. Do you think that Tito actually did more damage by reimposing these national lines?
I mean, yes, but it's also, it wasn't really Tito doing it, you know, it was the Communist Party that was doing it. And they were even imposed some of these policies onto Tito. Tito was personally had like, was inclined, especially after the experience of being the leader of the partisan movement. He had a soft spot for Yugoslavism, you know, although that, I mean, they kept this name that they were very much against. Before the war, they saw it as remnants of the monarchist regime and this idea of establishing a Yugoslav integral nation, which they thought was like a greater Serbian idea, and they opposed it. They wanted to form a Balkan federation of nation states that would include Bulgaria and Albania, ideally Greece as well. This was agreed, but then there was a split between the Yugoslav party and the Soviet Union, so this couldn't happen. And then they were left with Yugoslavia, so they kept that name, but organized it as a sort of Balkan Federation, basically. But then slowly started because the Yugoslav kind of idea was very popular during the war in the partisan movement, but then when the war ended, they more and more kind of abandoned that idea and try to persuade people not to like declare themselves Yugoslav as their ethnicity in the census and so on. And for example, Tito was one of these people who was persuaded not to declare himself as a Yugoslav by nationality. Mm. At some point, he was basically, you know, made by the Communist Party to declare himself Croatian because they didn't want to. I would say it wasn't him so much as the whole ideology that they adopted and then structured the whole system according to it, which was very much influenced by Leninism or Marxism, Leninism. Keep in mind, they were a Stalinist party, although they had a split with Stalin. They sort of said, you know, obviously Stalin was wrong. Until some point, he was totally correct and then got corrupted or something like that, and they are like authentic communists, meaning Stalinist. And then of course they added some things to that ideology which were specifically Yugoslav, like the emphasis on self-management and the non-aligned movement and so on, but mm-hmm. essentially,
yeah, this is what I want to address next.
Essentially they were, you know, of this Stalinist origin. So I would say that this ideology is why all of this happened, not Tito specifically. You know?
I want to go past ideology, though, right? Because now we're into the 1950s and the split between the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet bloc and Yugoslavia and Tito. It's not just an issue of ideology, because it seems to me, reading from your journal and just some of the things I know about Titoism now, as it's called, there's like a similar developmentalist need in what becomes Yugoslavia as there was in, say, the Soviet Union of the 1920s and the 1930s, which is that as a peripheral economy through the early 20th century, the rise of a communist movement and a communist state comes along with a need for a sort of national-driven modernization and developmentalism, which is going to like allow for the productive fruits of industrial capital, you could say, to like to free the region of its backwardsness. So a lot of people these days, when they nod towards Titoism, nod towards this self-management, because in addition to being non-aligned in the geopolitical sphere, Yugoslavia also poses itself as like a different way to do developmentalism and a different way of doing like state planning, enterprise-driven development. Self-management, as we see from the article, I think it's in the second second edition of your journal, self-management in reality is far different from self-management in ideology or in perception, right? Like from the very beginning, self-management, which I think is actually historically a very heroic and interesting nod towards trying to get at you know, the contradictions and the exploitation within the capital labor relation, and also as it comes to be the like oligarchical bureaucratic state and the mass worker within the actually existing socialism. But talk a little bit about how self-management happens in practice and how it ends up devolving through the course of the later 20th century.
Well, okay, I didn't read that article in a long time, but
really put you on the spot. That's the one I went to immediately because I'm fascinated by this stuff and experiments around this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in short, what happened there, and there's a... I think there's an interesting book to read. Dan Jovich is the author. I think it exists in English. It's called Yugoslavia, the state that... What's the term in English?
Withered away, I think.
Withered away, yeah. It's a kind of a bizarre thesis because he says that it withered away, like in the Marxist sense. They dissolved the state. I mean, it's a bit bizarre. But it's a good book to understand the Yugoslav system politically and what self-management was. I mean, what that book shows and many other studies was that self-management, of course, was very bureaucratic and so on. It wasn't actual self-management because, I mean, how can... I mean, it wasn't self-management because...
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of contradictions there, right? You have self-management within a state capitalist system and also this dominating party apparatus.
In a state capitalist system that also had many neoliberal reforms in it, and like
especially by the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Market reforms in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, self management meant more market economy, and also more national economies. Like through self management, they formed national economical systems that were defined by the borders of the republics. Like there was a significant decline of, like, for example, companies or like work collectives who had their central in a different republic from where they were based. So they basically started functioning as separate national economies. They are cooperating closely with each other but are more and more separate. Is one of the
this becomes more and more of a problem later on when the political crisis gets worse. And then, you know, Croatia and Slovenia, for example, as the kind of two more most powerful economies, are, you know, in competition and sanctioning Serbia. And you know, there's this kind of internal dynamics.
So it's like an attempt to do socialism in one country, especially when there's a break from the Warsaw Bloc. But complicating that is the fact that it's more than one country within that. Right. But then complicating that is that this attempt to do industrialization and proletarianization and modernization presumes that, like, within this one country, you have like a total worker and a total capital, like the total capital being the state and then the total worker being like all of the labor power within that, except that Yugoslavia is interpenetrated by like a much larger total capital and a much larger total worker, which is the world economy.
Yeah.
So like immediately this pressure leads to austerity, and the state driven aspect, it seems to me, immediately leads to like a contradiction between the stated goals, which is that the workers of a shop floor, the workers of a factory, the workers of a sector and an industry should be the ones running, controlling, managing production. But then you have the necessity, of course, for there to be this arbiter of the state and the bureaucracy in order to like bring that along.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, there's also this element of labor discipline to worker self-management where you say like, well, we're socialists here. We're working for the socialist project, which means for the essentially the national project. So you get Che Guevara, for example, arguing for something like worker self-management after the revolution in Cuba, which really means that workers will labor not for wages or for like a better economic position for themselves, but for the socialist project, which is just a way of imposing a labor discipline.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it depends on your politics, what you think about that, right? Like, is there like a universal need for labor discipline to be imposed like across time and across systems? I don't think that that's actually true. I think that, like, as Marx talked about, the actual like industrial capitalism and industrialization, industrial production itself is the seed, right, of the like imposition of labor discipline upon the worker. And so if you're going to continue to have separate entities, as you did in Yugoslavia, that are based on a profit and a loss system and interacting with the world market, it's what a self-management system is, in essence, is like the self-management of your own exploitation.
Yes.
To the extent to which that could be getting rid of, you know, in like a socialism in more than one country and five republics or whatever, I think is an open question and an important one. But I think we can see, like, through the actual historical and sort of like political economic essence of what Yugoslavia was and what it was trying to do, the limitations of this vision when you still keep the hell of the firm, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is also, I think, it's tied to the kind of the progressivist evolutionary ideology that they adopted, which, I mean, is the, I think, you know, a part of Orthodox Marxism where they come from, is like this idea that capitalism is inevitable in a progressive stage of humanity that, you know, everyone needs to go through, which was not what the Balkan socialists thought in the 19th century. But with the dominance of like Orthodox Marxism, this change into this direction, and it was also tied with the idea of nation, you know, the inevitability and the progressiveness of being organized as a nation. So, you're right to like, okay, it's an open question for us as anarchists and communists, how are we gonna make the society that we want to make? But I think these people and a lot of people who defend this history have a problem like facing what this movement was, that it was an incredibly pro-capitalist and pro-nationalist movement, you know. Just was like, I mean, if you use, you know, Marx and his analysis of capitalism, you cannot define this as anything else but capitalism. And they were very enthusiastic about this, you know, and introducing it where it didn't exist in that form before. Like, they totally abandoned, in the 19th century, like, one of the most important socialists was this guy from Serbia called Svetozar Marković, who was not a Marxist, he was not an anarchist, he was this kind of
a secret third thing.
which was very spread in the 19th century. It was, you know, like, maybe, like, something similar to Russian populists, for example.
Narodnik stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so the movement that was influenced by him as the theoretician, they thought that people in the Balkans should use the remnants of old pre-modern institutions that still existed, of like local self-management, really. And use them not in some kind of static form, but critically, to make them less patriarchal and so on, but use them as a vehicle to creating a communist society. And this was abandoned.
Which is something that Marx starts nodding towards the end of his life in the 1880s with the Russian Mir, right?
Yeah. But this was completely abandoned. So like in the beginning of the 20th century, for example, in Belgrade, you have like some smaller but very active like revolutionary syndicalists, factions, and also anarchist, anarcho-syndicalist factions, and there's a very small but very militant labor movement that is organizing a lot of strikes. They're sometimes very militant, and these are like new proletarians or like new like factory proletarians who came from the countryside to the city and are working in very bad conditions. And you already have a social democratic party of Serbia existing, which will be one of the organizations that will later, in some years, found the Communist Party of Yugoslavia, which is this kind of orthodox Marxist group. The leadership of it is, not everyone in it is. And they're not big fans of these strikes at all. And like you can read correspondence of the leadership of the party, and they are saying things like, well, these workers are crazy. They don't want to do anything but be on strike. And this is like not...
we'll have that.
Yeah. And we can't have that because Serbia is a backwards agrarian country. We need foreign investments in order to develop capitalism so that we'll be able to have socialism at some point. And if these workers are striking all the time, there won't be any foreign investments and so on. Yeah,
we're picking up a theme maybe as like we transition over into the bonus section, right? Which is that Titoism and the Yugoslavia that existed arises in very definite historical conditions, developmental conditions, and that the reason why Marxist-Leninist ideology, as you know, taken from Moscow, becomes popular is because Yugoslavia is facing many of the same issues that, say, the Soviet Union was in the 1920s and 1930s. So when we look back on the Yugoslav period, I think it's important that we all note that, like, the conditions that would face a revolutionary movement and the construction of a communist or anarchist society or whatever today would be radically different from what they would be back then, because I have to imagine that the proletarianization aspect of the 20th century and Titoism what was successful in Yugoslavia, right? You don't have like a large peasant sector any longer. You don't have like a large non-monetary economy or whatever. So like we can kind of historically bracket this stuff, I think, as like a previous attempt that to try to turn it into like a model of socialist construction in the future elides all the differences of the 20th century from today.
Yeah, I think a subtitle of one of our texts from second issue is, it's about Yugoslavia, and says the subtitle is something like the ideology of transition from capitalism through capitalism to capitalism. And I think that's
going to happen. Yeah, so let's transition to the bonus on the other side of the paywall. We'll talk a little bit more about what's in Anti-Politica, and we'll talk about how nationalism expresses itself today in the Balkans. The primary venue for it is, of course, cursed Balkan YouTube comments. And one of them. Yeah. We'll talk about as well the way that Balkanization is spreading to the United States in the form of the Greater Idaho Movement.
Okay.
So if you want to hear that part, please subscribe at patreon.com/theantifada at $5 a month or $10 a month, or for a discount if you subscribe annually. We really appreciate that. Tell us where people can check out Empire Never Ended and Anti-Politica Journal.
Empire Never Ended, you should be able to get everywhere you get your podcasts. And then we do bonus episodes on Patreon as well. So patreon.com/tenetpod and Empire Never Ended everywhere else.
We have a Twitter as well. Also, Tenetpod is the
handle. That we barely use.
Yes, but follow us.
Yes.
I think it's an Xer now, it's called.
Oh, yeah.
It's edgy. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Oops.
Maybe you guys can get a blue check and start. Maybe you guys can get a blue check and start becoming your own type of cranks.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see everybody on the other side. Ona pieści jej o tym, każe ci ucierać w tym.